Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today I feel very fortunate. I know it's Friday, and a lot of you are saying, yo, it's Friday, yippee, I got a weekend to look forward to, and I agree with that. But today we've got a good way, I think, of ending this week's programming, because we're going to be talking with a young man who has been on the front lines of war. This is not a subject that most of us feel like we want to talk about. Many times we'll hear it politically tossed about like a football, but the reality of what war presents and how it affects a human being too often is brushed under the rug. Well, there is a young man, Michael Anthony, who decided that after he served his time overseas, he was going to write about his experiences. He titled it Mass Casualties, A Young Medic's True Story of Death, Deception, and Dishonor in Iraq. I want to welcome Michael Anthony to the show. How are you today, Michael?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
You're a young man that stepped outside of the box to write about a personal experience of being overseas. I'd like to ask you a question right off the bat. How have your fellow soldiers responded to this kind of a publication?
It's been a really positive thing. Before the book even came out, it was verified by dozens of soldiers in my unit. So I mean, it's just really a raw, true story of what happens over there. I have gotten some, I wouldn't say really negative, but just some not positive feedback emails where they said, you shouldn't have told these stories, or it's none of the civilians' business what goes on during war,
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, I mean, military people are, just all about, sharing the stories and the truth about what goes on over there, It was so sad where they just did this study of, the best war books in the past, like, 10 years, and
mm-hmm.
more than half of these war books were by journalists, And from a veteran's standpoint, it's just so sad to see that, our voice and, is coming from, journalists, people that weren't even really there. We were there for, a few weeks or a month. And, over there, the war's being fought by the people that are really affected are either the Iraqis or the American soldiers. And it was just so sad to see that all these books that were being praised as these best books didn't have any voice of the Iraqis or the American soldiers. And I think that's one of the big things veterans are really, getting out there and just starting to realize, like, listen, why don't you just hear it from our voice? Why don't you just hear what really goes on? I know this
mm-hmm.
this new movie, The Hurt Locker. I've been hearing there's been a lot of veterans that are speaking out against this because they're just saying it's inaccurate, and veterans are getting tired of our stories just being laden with inaccuracies from
mm-hmm.
Hollywood or different publishers or just the news media, the left or the right or whatever. They're just getting tired of just inaccuracies. And I think that's what a lot of veterans came together for Mass Casualties. We've got endorsements from pro-war people, anti-war people, Democrats, Republicans, enlisted officers, Marines, Army. We've got it all in there, just people coming together and say, this is a real depiction of what goes on over there. It's not perfect. It's not, this or that. It's just a real depiction.
It's fascinating, and I really appreciate it, because you're not the first soldier I've interviewed on my show. And in today's world, I think it's important that we have transparency about what is going on. When you talk to people that were in World War I, and there's very few that are still alive that were, and even those that were in World War II, most of them came out of that. In their generations, you didn't talk about it. You just sort of sucked it up, and that's the way it was. When you became sick or something went wrong, well, that was your duty. That's just what you had to experience. And now a lot of those people from that generation who might be in their 80s are beginning to write stories, and I've had the privilege of interviewing them, and it gives you an inside look, and that's what your book has done, Mass Casualties. You have a poem right at the first of your book, which I would like to share with my listeners. It's called Reintegration. This is by Samuel W. Tarr. Straighten up. It's all right. You can look me in the eyes. True, I am an American soldier serving this country called home. This does not mean I've humiliated prisoners, burnt villages, or killed any babies. I am just like you. There was a time when I felt the same, that this uniform meant something. I reached for it and all it offered, only to be led into war by mercenaries, hopeless and blind. Now that my tour is over, let me slip back into the world that I left behind. We are now simply neighbors, occupying the same tenement with the rats in the basement and the leaking roof. So, please, save your parade. I've got no use for it now. I was just doing my job. Samuel W. Tarr. Poignant words. And then, in your prologue, you follow with this. You're going to war. It is no longer a question of if you are going to go, but a question of when. Look around. In a few years or even a few months, several of you will be dead. Some of you will be severely wounded or so badly mutilated that your own mother can't stand the sight of you. And for the real unlucky ones, you will come home so emotionally disfigured that you'll wish you had died over there. Who said those words to you?
That was my drill sergeant during basic training. Yeah. They were just trying to get us ready for that mindset where, you know, you're 18 and you have to get ready to go and fight and possibly kill, but at the same time you have to get ready for the fact that on the other side of the world there's a whole group of other 18-year-olds that are getting ready to fight and possibly kill you. And I think they just wanted to get us ready for that, mm-hmm. you know, mindset that you're 18, but you could be dead in a year from now, you know. And I think that's what they really wanted to, you know, hit home with us. And that was a big thing for me, like, oh, you know, this is real. And, like, a few months after that, you know, one of the people from my platoon of 60 people, he was dead, you know. And that was just a few months later. He was, you know, 18, 19. And that was just the reality of it, you know. It just took off from there.
I really have to say something about this, having had members of family that were in the military. Those people that have to do the training, usually they have walked the walk themselves. And if they're a sergeant, they look at you and they realize that that is exactly what they have to do. They have to indoctrinate you so that you're going to get out of what I call the TV mentality. This isn't a storybook. This is ugly. This is nasty stuff. They have to equip you to the best capacity that they possibly can. And even then, they don't even know that you're going to survive it. But if they don't do it, there is no nice way of preparing for war. It does not exist. Am I right or am I wrong?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. It's like you said, the TV mentality, you know, going in at that point, we don't have any experience of anything except for what we've seen in movies or anything like that, and they just have to get us ready for the real experience. Like, you could die, you could lose arms or legs or come back, you know, with, you know, PTSD, you know, emotionally disfigured.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that reality. Like you said, this isn't playing, you know, Halo or, you know, whatever those computer games is. This is real, real life.
Right. One of the descriptions that you give, and I thought it's fascinating because it just really gives you pause. You go into an environment, you're in Mosul, Iraq, and you say the sky is yellow, orange, and brown, scratched together, not like the blue sky in Boston, and an Iraqi is staring at you. He's wearing a black and white turban, which tells you he's been to Mecca, but you've never seen his skin tone before, which is what you describe as a golden auburn. Now, this is something that I don't know many people would even consider, that would be, in your mind, something brand new. You've seen a lot of books, you've been around a lot of different people, but it's a whole different environment there, isn't it?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, that was the first thing right when we get off the plane. You know, in Iraq, a lot of the buildings, they're only, you know, one story tall. At most, they're two stories tall, and they're all, you know, brown, sand-colored buildings. So we get off the plane, and, you know, we just see all these brown sand-colored buildings everywhere. There's a few Iraqis standing off to the side. You know, they have their shops there. And there's all these just one-story buildings everywhere. You know, they're all the same color. And then just off in the distance, we see this huge white dome, and it's the military gym. And it just looks so out of place with these you know, one-story, you know, brown little huts everywhere. And then off in the distance, you just see this, like, a massive, like, huge dome. And you can just tell it's just looking out of place because the house is blended in. You know, the house with the same color as the sand, you know, in the sky was just, you know, this brown color. I'd never seen it, you know, here in Boston. You know, the sky was the same color as the sand, the same color of the houses. And, you know, just this people's, you know, skin tone, they just had that same color. Like, they all just kind of, like, belonged in this mesh. And then off in the distance was, like, this huge, like, you know, white dome that was our gym. And that was just the first thing that hit me coming off, like, oh, you know, right there.
One of the feelings that you describe as a medic, and I know when you are dealing with life and death situations, which were occurring almost daily, you said you had to detach yourself. You couldn't allow any emotion about a patient. You could not get too caught up with whether they lived or died. And before we went on the air, I told you I was going to make a comment about this. I felt that your book was almost like a composite of what is portrayed in NCIS and also MASH, which was, you know, it's just amazing to me. I mean, you talk about the sideline wit that people use just to be able to survive the agony of what they're dealing with, the rush of patients coming in at times. And has anyone else responded to you with that kind of an observation of what you've written?
Yeah, I've heard it compared to MASH a lot. Actually, I had never watched MASH before until a few months ago when, you know, a bunch of people were like, oh, yeah, this is like MASH. You should watch that TV show or the movie or something like that. Never watched before. And then I finally watched it a few months ago. I was just, you know, I was floored. I was like, you know, MASH, this is exactly what it's like over there. You know, here we are, you know, 50 years later, they were depicting the Korean War, and here we are, you know, 50, 60 years later, and it's like the same. And, you know, MASH was one of the most accurate depictions of, you know, war I had ever seen. You know, they just got the absurdity across, you know. Everything's not always cut and dry like the movies appear, where it's always, you know, this great, this glorious, you know, heroes, everyone's a, you know, perfect hero. MASH just got this absurdity across.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's what I try to do in an extent. You know, I'd never seen it before, but that's what I just try to give it, you know, just the real depiction, you know, not try to make it better than it was or worse than it was, just the real absurdity of some of the stuff that goes on over there. Because, I mean, it is just humans over there, no matter what. We're not, it's just not, you know, robotic soldiers. It's just humans trying to do their own thing. And for the apathy part of it, you know, working in a medical field, if you read all these stories on the newspaper, you know, this big crash, this big explosion, in Iraq there's only a handful of level 3 trauma hospitals that could, you know, actually take in, you know, these
mm-hmm.
patients. And our unit ran two of them out of, you know, less, you know, this small handful. So anytime you would hear about, you know, any of these bad things happening on the news or anything like that, a majority of the time they'd be going to us. I mean, we just got to see it, you know, every day, you know. Any bad thing you hear out there, we'd be seeing it every day. And then
mm-hmm.
seeing that every day, you kind of got to turn yourself off because you can't allow yourself to, you know, care so much every time. You can't be like, oh, you know, this patient comes in and this patient comes in. You're just going to get overwhelmed. Then you just got to start looking at them like, you know, forget it. It doesn't matter if they live or die. As long as I do my job the best that I can. And you got to just stop caring about it because you got to just focus on your job no matter what and just not care about anything. You just got to turn the emotions off and just focus on your job and do the best you can and just not care if anyone lives or die, whether it's an Iraqi insurgent or it's an American soldier. You just got to do
mm-hmm.
your job.
Because,
mm-hmm. I mean, if you care once when somebody dies, you're going to have another patient to work on right away, and you can't work on them if you're still caring about the last patient. You're going to be all torn up and crying. You won't be able to do surgery on the next person, so you just got to basically stop caring.
When you signed up for the military, you took an ASVAB test, ASVAB test, Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery Test. Your score was outstanding, and the Army said you could have any job you wanted. And what you said to the recruiter, which I found interesting, is that you'd take whichever job had the highest bonus and the biggest kicker for school. And he said an OR medic gets an $8,000 bonus and a monthly GI Bill kicker for college of $350 a month. And he did tell you what an OR medic does, but you said you were 17 when you were talking to the recruiter, and your mind was too focused on the $8,000, and you said 3 years later you would give back every cent to not be where you were at that time. You'd pay double, triple, but you had set yourself up for this. You said, the money's gone, the contract is signed, and I'm here in Iraq preparing for surgery. You talk about the surgery mode and how they would just, there's no, gee whiz, sir, the patient's bleeding. It's like, this is what I need. You had to operate just like a machine, correct?
Yeah, I mean, we tried the best I can. Like I said, we were just humans, but I mean, we had to try to turn it off as best we can and be as mechanical as we can. I mean, we still had our human peccadilloes, but in the surgery, we had to just, you know, just not care about the patient, just focus on that, doing our jobs, you know, and that's why we kind of would make jokes or play music in the background. It was just so we could just focus on our jobs. We might as well wouldn't have been working on a car, you know. It's just nuts and bolts, and we just do everything we can and just be ready for the next patient.
Now, you had to carry a weapon with you at all times, did you not?
Yeah, I mean, all soldiers carry a weapon with them 24/7. I mean, we weren't doing surgery with our weapons on us. They were kept lock and key, but I mean, the rest of the time we would have to walk around with weapons 24/7.
Now, you experienced mortars going off around you, and that, your first experience with that, it was pretty terrifying, wasn't it?
Oh, I mean, our first day in Iraq, we'd got a bad mortar attack, and what would happen is, you know, the planes would come down and land, and then we were right next to a city so that the insurgents could see all these people coming off an airplane, and they'd like to attack at that moment when they see people coming off an airplane. So it happened the last 3 years when a new unit came in to replace another unit.
Mm-hmm.
The same day that the base would get attacked really bad, and it happened, you know, 3 years in a row. So that our first night there, we got attacked really bad, and one of the people that was getting ready to go home, you know, had spent a whole year in Iraq getting ready to go home, he gets injured, you know, a nurse, and then they just bomb us really bad. And it was just our first day there. We're like, oh, holy crap, you know, we're in war, you know, this is it, you know, we're almost dying right here, and it's day one. We got a mass casualty, and we mortar attack.
When you had emergencies coming in, the surgeries that had to be done, and a lot of it was just really hideous. It's not unlike what's going on in Haiti, you know, although in Haiti it was an earthquake. Here you are with a bombardment, you have these various conditions that come in, and you would have Iraqis come in, and you would have children, you'd have men, you'd have women, and you took them all in. The American medical teams worked on all of them, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. It was Geneva Convention states that you just got to treat all patients the same. You know, if an Iraqi insurgent comes in and an American soldier comes in, you know, we've got to give them both the same care. There was a story when there was an Iraqi insurgent sniper who's going around sniping out American soldiers. And the American soldiers, they wear their body armor and they wear their Kevlar. You know, they were both bulletproof. But wearing your body armor and your Kevlar, there's a little spot in the back of your neck that's uncovered. And this Iraqi sniper, he'd go out and shoot American soldiers right in the back of the neck during that you know, few-inch spot that was uncovered. And, you know, he'd killed a bunch of people. Snipers do a hit-and-run. And this one sniper had killed a bunch of people, and then he'd, you know, run. And there's one day when the sniper goes out and he shoots an American soldier, but he gives away his position, and our soldiers find the sniper, and they shoot him, but they only injure him. They don't kill him. So they take the injured American soldier back to our hospital, and then they take the Iraqi insurgent back to the hospital to the sniper. And we had to do surgery on both of them, and they were in the same exact OR room on beds that were only, you know, a few feet away. We had to do surgery on them at both the exact same time, and they were only, you know, maybe 4 feet away from each other, both of them, you know, fighting on their lives on the same beds. And, you know, only an hour before, they were trying to kill each other. And that's just Geneva Conventions right there. We treated them both exact the same. You know, they were only a few feet away getting both the same medical care. And that just, we had to do that. You know, that's Geneva Convention, so.
With you as a soldier in doing this, how long were you overseas in Iraq?
We were overseas for 12 months.
For 12 months. And were you injured while you were there?
No, I was not injured over there. I don't think none of our hospital got injured by enemy combatants. You know, people get injured through their own, you know, happenings, but none of our unit got injured by enemy combatants.
Now, you also had some issues with some of the people in the upper ranks, and you talk about the good old boys, GOBs, gobs. Tell us about the gobs.
Well, yeah, I mean, sometimes people are, you know, I've met a lot of people that are under the impression that everything and everyone in the military is perfect, which is great. You know, it's great that people are supporting their troops and, you know, behind them, even if they don't support the war. But it's still the same thing where they put every single soldier on a pedestal. And the real reason that I had decided to write the book is I was home for about 2 months, and I was on a date with this girl. And this girl starts telling me about this article she had read in this newspaper. The article was about this soldier in Iraq. And she tells me about the article and how it describes this soldier as if he's the American hero, as if, you know, he's the epitome of what an American hero is, as if G.I. Joe is based on this guy. So she tells me about the article, and then she tells me the guy's name. Turns out the guy was in my unit. He was one of the good old boys in my unit. He was one of the commanders. And this was one of the good old boys that was one of those deplorable characters. He was just a dirty shame to the uniform. He was the one that tried to put my friend and I in jail. He was the one that tried to cover up my friend's suicide, and he was covering up all these crimes in Iraq. And he was just this deplorable character and the shame to the uniform. And to hear him being called this American hero and placed on the same pedestal as people who are true American heroes, it just made me sick to my stomach. And I called my friend up from my unit in Iraq, and his first reaction was like, you know, let's go burn this guy's house down. You know, and I told him to calm down, you know, and that's when I decided to write the book. So there are certain circumstances over there that don't, put people in the best light. You know, sometimes war can bring out the best in us, and sometimes it can bring out the worst in us. And I think sometimes people only like to tell the good stories while leaving out the bad ones, thinking it's going to make everything, you know, good. You know, even though they have good intentions to only tell the good stories, you know, mm-hmm. The only way for us to change things or to help things is to admit the bad ones and admit what needs to change. And I saw a lot of bad stuff over there. And then come back home, you know, one of the good old boys who should be kicked out of the military or possibly even in jail got promoted to general. This other guy had this newspaper article on him who he should be kicked out of the military, possibly even in jail. And yet we come back home and they're being praised as these, you know, American heroes and put on these same pedestals as other people. So even though, you know, there's stories that go back and forth, there's a lot of good stories, but there are some bad stories. And I think only telling the good ones, even though intentions are good, we're not going to be able to change any of the bad stuff that happens over there. And with rising suicide rates in the military and rising PTSD rates, it's clear that not everything is good in the military. And for us to be able to change things, we've got to tell what's wrong and what needs to be changed.
You have a very touching story in here. It's about letters from third and fourth graders that come in to those of you who are overseas. And you said the kids write letters supporting something they know nothing about, only that they're told to support their country in the war. Some kids will draw pictures of the American flag and men in uniform and send them to us. Every now and again we'll get the cards and letters from a kid whose parent died in the war. Those ones are the most difficult to read, and you know you've got to reply to them. You said the worst story was about a little kid's father who died during the first invasion of Iraq. Tell us about that story.
Well, you know, there's all these, you know, superstition things that soldiers have, and there's this one story that people are going, you know, we get letters all the time from first and third graders, and there's this one story about this third grade kid who, first to third grade kid, and his father had, you know, died in the first, in the beginning of the war, and then once he learned how to, you know, read and write, he started writing, you know, letters to soldiers overseas, and he starts writing this one soldier, and you know, he starts writing this one soldier, and the soldier starts writing back to him, and then the soldier gets killed in combat. And then the little kid, you know, he doesn't know the soldier's killed, so he keeps on writing letters, and then one of the guy's friends finds out that the kid's still writing letters, so he starts writing the kid. The kid starts writing him back, and then that guy dies too. So it was just one of these superstitious things that soldiers had over there, like, oh, you know, there's this one unlucky kid that's sending letters to people that, you know, it's kind of like you jinx, but that was just one of those superstitious stories we had over there.
Well, I think when you are face-to-face with war, a bullet doesn't necessarily have anybody's name on it. It's a bullet. It's who is going to use the weapon that the bullet is contained within and who's going to pull the trigger and aim it, just like the sniper you were talking about earlier. With a young person today, with the way things are, what would you want to say to a young man or a young woman who thinks that this is something they'd want to do, what would you want them to know in the way of a message?
Well, I would just let them know that things aren't always as they seem, you know. I would tell them to take the time to hear both sides of the story. You know, you see all these cool, you know, commercials on TV that make things appear great. You know, you see these military people, commercials of military guys, like, jumping out of airplanes and stuff like that, where, truth be told, you know, the military is actually closing airborne schools, and there hasn't been an airborne attack in, you know, 70 years. But yet they're still showing all these commercials, you know, join the military, jump out of airplanes, when they're closing schools down. There hasn't been an air invasion in 70 years. And it's just that difference between what, you know, what these cool commercials and YouTube videos show you, how intense it is, and then the reality of, you know, what it is. And I would just tell people to take the time to actually feel out your options and take the time to know what you're getting into. And I think that's one of the reasons that we do have such high rates for, you know, soldiers and veterans. You know, they just, they never took the time. They didn't know what they were getting into, so they weren't ready to, you know, handle it. And I think that's one of the biggest problems is going into something and not knowing what you're going into. And I think just having that knowledge of, you know, the truth and what it really is would help out a lot more people going in and coming back home. So I would just tell these people, just take the time to hear the real stories and not just, you know, watch the news or, you know, these commercials on YouTube or anything like that. Take the time to hear the stories from the people that are actually there.
Let's talk about anthrax, the vaccine. That was a very significant section in your book. And there was a comment that you put in there saying, as of 2006, 1.2 million troops had been given the anthrax shot. Of the 1.2 million, over 20,000 have been hospitalized because of direct complications due to the anthrax shot or some mysterious illness that occurred after they had gotten it. And the symptoms can range from losing bone marrow and blood platelets to the shrinking of the brain and Lou Gehrig's disease, and that there has been zero research into the long-term effects of the anthrax shot. That was quite a statement in your book. Were you able to say no to the anthrax shot, or are you forced when you're in the military to have it?
Well, it's the military has made it mandatory for all soldiers to get these anthrax shots. So we were over in Iraq, and they come down, they're like, oh, it's mandatory, you guys all got to get these shots. So, like, you know, that's, you know, why would they make this mandatory? That's interesting. So my friend and I, we go on Google, and we Google anthrax shot, and the first 30 pages that come up on Google are all just these negative things about the anthrax shot, how there's soldiers dying from taking the anthrax shot, how, I don't know if you've heard of the Gulf War syndrome from the first Gulf War,
yes.
That's linked to the anthrax shot. And, you know, it's our generation, it's Agent Orange. And we hear all these terrible things, and we find out that the FDA approved the anthrax shot, but as soon as the company got FDA approval, they had changed all the compounds around in the shot, but kept the same name, which was FDA approved. And then we find out that the only reason the military is making all these anthrax shots mandatory is because they bought a huge batch during the first Gulf War, and they were about to expire, and they wanted to use them all up before they expired. So we found out all these statistics, like you're thousands of times more likely to get sick from the anthrax shot or even die from the anthrax shot than ever come in contact with anthrax ever. Even in Iraq, there's been zero anthrax attacks in Iraq or Afghanistan up to date, even now. And the anthrax attacks only protect against the particle form, not the airborne anthrax that we were threatened with bombs and stuff like that. So, I mean, we just found out all these things, all these soldiers dying from it, you know, being seriously injured from it. My roommate's friend who was in the military, he got the anthrax shot. Now he's got the flu for the rest of his life now. And, you know, flu-like symptoms, you know, just that lethargic feeling and the flu symptoms for the rest of his life now. And we just found out all these things. And the only reason they were making it mandatory is because they were all about to expire. So, I mean, at that point where it's just like, you know, this is crazy, you know. I mean, this is more likely to, you know, harm us or even kill us than for us to them to ever do us any good. So then our commanders make it mandatory, and then they tell us, you know, either, you know, get the shot. And then a third of our unit refuses to take the shot. All the doctors, all the nurses, all these anesthesiologists, they say, you know, wait, we ain't taking that shot. We know it's bad for us. So they all refuse to take the shot. And this makes our commanders, the good old boys, look really bad that we're a medical unit and all these doctors are refusing it. You know, it makes the Army look bad and it makes our commanders look bad. So then they come down and they say, you know what, if you refuse a direct order during a time of war, we can put you in jail. So here we are, we're in Iraq, we're 6,000 miles away, you know, we're fighting for a country, we're in the medical field, we're saving lives, and we're being told that if we don't take this shot, that's statistically more likely to harm us or even kill us than for us to do any good, that if we don't take this shot, we're going to be put in jail. So here we are, you know, we're in Iraq fighting, you know, for our country and saving people's lives. And, you know, our commanders are threatening us. So if a few more people get the shot, you know, they cave in, you know, we're being threatened with not only that, but if we they can kick us out of the military and with a dishonorable discharge, which follows you around like a felony. So there was all these doctors that had their private practices and their licenses through the military. They would have lost their last 25, 30 years of their life, their retirement. They would have become basically a felon. So eventually all these people start getting the shot, and then basically it's only my friend and I that are holding out where, you know, we're not getting the shot. And then my NCYC comes up to us, and he basically tells us that if we refuse a direct order during a time of war, he can shoot us. And he kind of gives us the impression that, you know, he's really pissed at us and that we didn't think he would really do it, but just the fact that he would even threaten us, that we're 6,000 miles away fighting for a country, and our commanders are threatening us with jail time if we don't take the shot, or NCYC is threatening to shoot us if we don't take this shot, that's thousands of times more likely to get us sick. So at this point, it wasn't really a question of whether or not it's healthy for us. It's just a question of principle and ethics. Could they really force us to put this shot in our body when we know it's not good for us just because it's about to expire? So, I mean, that was just one of those stories over there that you just don't hear about it in the everyday media, mm-hmm. even though they do happen, you know.
Absolutely.
People just don't publicize stuff like that.
Well, Michael, I know we're out of time, and I want to say your book is really an eye-opener, and I'm so grateful that you've written it, and I commend you for being honest and that you are speaking to veterans, you're sharing this book and doing whatever you can to pass on understanding, not to badmouth the military, but you're just telling it as it is, because in your book you say being in the Army and being overseas really helped you become a man. Do you have a website that people
yes.
can go to?
If anyone wants to check out the my website or shoot me an email, it's masscasualties.com.
Masscasualties.com, a young medic's true story. Again, Mark Anthony, thank you for being my guest today. This is Donna Sebo. Go to his website, masscasualties.com. It's worth a read, and it'll open your eyes to a side of life that most of us never, ever see. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. Mark Anthony again, thank you for being my guest. We'll be back in just a moment.
Thank you.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, TTAP.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's T-TAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717. TTAP.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open, and if you'd like to call in and let me light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, here is the telephone number, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, for those of you in the Pacific Northwest, I know you are absolutely loving the weather that we are having here. It is gloriously beautiful. It is so warm out, you don't even need a jacket. We've gone from chilly-willy levels of temperatures all the way up to just balmy compared to what we've had. So it's been gloriously beautiful. But I want you to get out your calendars, ladies, in the Pacific Northwest, because the Pacific Northwest Women's Show is coming up March 5th, 6th, and 7th. What an event it's going to be. It is going to be, over 40,000 women come out to this every year. And I believe it's in its 19th year, so it has just been well-loved by all the women in the Pacific Northwest. We're going to have fabulous speakers. There are hundreds of vendors. You can shop till you drop, wear good walking shoes, and be prepared. You're going to have a wonderful time. Bring your friends, and just know there's going to be good food, lots of fun, lots of information. You're just going to have all kinds of good things to experience. It's always a memorable time when you go to the Northwest Women's Show. Now, it's being held at the Quest Convention Center, right across from the Quest Field, and you're going to be able to have ample parking. There's just all kinds of space around the area for you to be able to spend the day, enjoy yourself. I'm going to be in booth number 407, and on Friday, March the 5th, I'm going to be the host for the forum that's going to be presented at the Girl Talk stage. We're going to have six powerful women who are going to be speaking. The first hour will be dedicated to financial well-being. The second hour will be dedicated to energy healing. The third hour will be dedicated to animals. So you can go to the Northwest Women's Show website. You can read about the information there. Also, you can go to my website. You'll find it. Information will be there in the newsletter. But I encourage you to mark that time on your calendar. I just am thrilled to be a part of this. It is just so much fun. I think this is my seventh year that I'm going into and being with them. So it's just a delight. And also, if you have a story about the paranormal, if you've had a unique experience of your own, I'd love to hear from you. I'm putting together a book where I hope to include 100 stories from people who have had paranormal experiences. And if you would like to be in that book, do send me your story via email to donna@delphiinternational.com, or you can make it snail mail to the Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. So keep those things in mind and tell your friends, too, because I really am interested in the stories. 888-815-9756 is the telephone number to call into today if you would like to chat with me. Now, how would you like to make money while you are surfing the net? Well, if this is something you thoroughly enjoy doing, if you absolutely love surfing the net, there are ways to make money. I am absolutely amazed when this information crosses my desk. Now, if you like to play online games, and there are millions of you that like to do this, well, you can go to Moolah, Moola.com, and you can play games, card, dice games, and you can compete to win cash. And you start off with a virtual penny, and your own cash is never at risk that you use to wager with while playing against a challenger. If you win the first game, you get two real pennies, and you can use those in to bet while playing more games to win more. It may not sound like a bunch, they say, but the cash can add up. Now, this is a story about someone that did this. Not only are games a fun way to make money, but there's a lady by the name of Pamela Simmons who does it to pass the time. Now, she's in her 40s, and she's in Colorado. She's a stay-at-home mom, and she said she's won $660 doing this. She said it is just so much fun. And they say there's a insider secret. Longtime players are happy to share their tips and tricks for winning games. All you have to do is go to the Moolah Forum and do a search for the name of a game you want to play better and read the advice. So, you know, you can go up to $10 in winnings and then cash out, but it is something that this lady, she has done quite well. Also, social networking. Now, for a lot of people in today's world, social networking via the Internet is quite big. Well, there is a social networking site, gather.com, and they'll pay you for connecting with old friends and making new ones. Now, all you need to do is set up an account, post updates about yourself, share photos, and send messages. The more activity on your account, the more points you rack up, which can be converted into cash payments or gift cards for big-name stores. And there's another bonus. It also sponsors contests that you can enter to win hundreds of dollars in prizes, including airline tickets, electronics, and DVDs. There's a woman by the name of Bridget Axtell. She's in her 30s. She lives in Idaho. She said she's not only made lots of new friends, but she earns about $1,200 a year in cash and about $2,400 a year in prizes. She said, not only did I recently use this extra money to fund a trip for my family, but we also vacationed with another family that I met on the website. Now, this is what they call the insider secret. To maximize your earnings, you need to be as interactive as possible by logging on daily, even for just 10 or 15 minutes. And you need to join a lot of different social groups and comment on other people's posts. And you spread the word. When your friends and family join, it's not only more fun, but you also get extra points for attracting new users. So you can go in. The account is free at gather.com. Fill out your profile, and you're off and running. So if that's something that, you know, what you're really interested in, it's up to you. But I would just say be wise, because you don't want to have too much of your information out on the net. Anybody and everybody is out there. Also, blogs. Now, there's a lot of people that have blogs. They are really big, big, important ones. I saw something on a woman in her 80s. Her grandson started a blog showing her cooking her favorite family recipes. And, you know, she has just attracted all kinds of people. She has young women that just say, I don't have a grandma, but you just fit the bill. It's just wonderful. I love to watch what you do. So this young woman's grandson takes care of everything. She does the cooking and he does the filming, and it's all there for people to see. Now, you can earn a commission. If you have a blog, you can earn a commission by linking to store sites. Now, if you enjoy writing about cooking tips or photography or whatever it is, it's just your special love, you can get paid for this. You sign up for an affiliate program, which simply means you'll have to have a link on your blog to various store websites such as Amazon or drugstore, Target, or, you know, any one of the big ones. And then for every click on a link that results in a sale, you earn 2 to 15% of the purchase price in commissions from those companies. Now, there's a woman by the name of Tara who has a website, and she said she earns $2,000 a month having all of these links. And there was a woman that said she has 5 kids, she sticks to products that she's passionate about, and she said the people that are coming to my website, they're usually going to have the same interest. So you have to build trust. If you have a blog, you have to build trust with your audience, and she said the one way I do that is to promote only the products I would buy for myself and my family. Now, you can get a blog of your own. If you have time to do that, start one for free at blogger.com. WordPress.com or LiveJournal.com, and then you go to the CommissionJunction.com, which partners with, my goodness, lots and lots and lots of businesses, and you fill out affiliate applications. Now, once they approve you, then you'll be provided with an easy cut-and-paste link to put on your blog so you can start earning money right away. And once your blog builds up the following that you'd like to have, companies will pay you $10, $50, or even $100 to post a review about a product or a service. Now, you can sign up at loudlaunch.com, sponsoredreviews.com or socialspark.com and then pick from the offers that they have. So that's just a little bit of trivia about things that you can do on the Internet. And I had some other things that were given to me, but I'll save that for another time. This is Donna Sebo. If you'd like to chat with me today, give me a buzz at 888-815-9756. Donna Sebo here. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. I'd be delighted to share my intuitive skills with you. 888-815-9756. And also, I wanted to let you know about my guests that are going to be coming up next week. We've got a great lineup of people. We're going to be talking with Bruce Zemelski on Monday. He is a firefighter and paramedic, and he's written memoirs about his experiences, some fun stories, conversations with Richard Bandler, who was, is the father of, considered the father of neurolinguistic programming. We're going to be talking with Owen Fitzpatrick. He has been very much a student of Richard Bandler's and travels around the world teaching people about NLP. And then, yes, Valentine's Day, it is coming around the corner. We're going to be talking with Dr. Craig Martin, Elementary Love Styles. We'll be talking a little bit of astrology, a little bit of this, and a little bit of that, just to get you ready for the fun holiday of Valentine's. Anthony Flacco is going to be my guest next Thursday, The Road Out of Hell. This book absolutely is one of the most profound pieces of investigative journalism that I have ever read. And I can't tell you, I mean, it just was amazing as a story. And it's also amazing that things like this even happen. But it's a powerful story, and we're going to be talking with Anthony about it. And then on Friday, a week from today, we're going to be talking about makeup. Don't break up. Dr. Bonnie Wheel is going to be my guest. So we've got a wonderful lineup of people. And if you want to find out more about the upcoming guests, check out BBS. And on the website, they have a listing of all the people coming up on the show. And I know that this is something that some of you really like to do. And tell your friends and just come on and drop on by and have a visit. I wanted to share something about Chinese seals. This is about global trade to a degree, and the information is amazing. So many times when we are hearing about history, it's only told in the way that a historian has their paradigm set. But now, as we have evolved into a time frame where technology is enabling us to get a better understanding of what's gone before. And archaeological discoveries are being worked with at a level that's unprecedented. we're finding out a lot of things we didn't know before. In 1780 in Ireland, the first Chinese porcelain seal, the kind that was used with sealing wax, was unearthed by a man who was cutting peat in a bog near Portalois. Now, the second one was found in a harbor cave in Cork, and another one was unearthed in an orchard beneath the roots of an ancient pear tree in County Down. Move along in time, in 1816, some more seals were discovered near a Dublin road in a plowed field in Tipperary and in River Boyne, where gravel was being raised. Another seal was found in a curiosity shop in London, but the shopkeeper said it had originally come from Ireland. By 1868, 61 of these Chinese seals had been found in Ireland. Now, all of these seals were one-inch cubes, with the exception of one single oval seal. Every one of them had miniature animals sitting on its top, and an exotic Chinese inscription was on the bottom. Now, a lot of people had a lot of ideas about this. Controversy, well, it was just among antiquarians. They just really were having a great time with this. You couldn't figure out some of the animals. Sometimes they didn't know what the script meant. And how in the world did these seals, how did they ever get to Ireland? Well, in the 1840s, a gentleman by the name of Edmund Getty decided he was going to investigate this. So he had copies made of every single one of these seals. And he sent these copies to a friend who was working in Hong Kong. Now, at that time, people didn't get answers real quick. They didn't have cell phones. They didn't have the internet. They didn't have a lot of things. It took him 2 years to get an answer. Two of the animals were identified as Chinese monkey and a Chinese lion. The inscriptions were dated from the time of Confucius, 500 B.C., although the age of these seals, they hadn't been able to figure out. There were two groups of Chinese scholars who were asked for translations, and they agreed on some of the meanings, such as a pure heart, but could not agree on all of the interpretations. A lot of the writings were very poetic in nature, pure as the breeze on the stream, heaven and water are of the same color, and also the arrow returns to him who trusts himself. Now that poses a lot of questions. What was going on in Ireland? And these seals found all over the place. Maybe one day someone will be able to figure it out. But we talk about global trade today as if, boy, this is something new. It's not. One of the great discoveries that's been made, you don't hear about it very often, but Chinese were going into South America centuries ago. Here in the Pacific Northwest, especially down in Oregon, the Japanese current, if there were the Japanese ships that were coming, if they got caught in that current, they'd automatically many times be forced to go into Oregon. And there was a time in Japanese history that if a sailor went off course by that current, landing in Oregon, he couldn't return to Japan because he'd be put to death. The Japanese government had cut off all outside contact. Fascinating story. Do I know about this? Yes. How? Well, I interviewed a man a couple of years ago named Ronald McDonald. No, I'm not talking about the McDonald's clown. This is a man, Ronald McDonald, who many, many years ago was the son of an Indian princess here in the Pacific Northwest. And that Indian princess was married to a man who worked for the Hudson Bay Company. This was wild, wild country then. And he was raised in an environment that enabled him to go to Japan. And historically, the Japanese honor Ronald McDonald to this day because they feel he was the reason why the Japanese government was forced to open up for trade with the United States. Why? Because he was a prisoner of a Japanese community, and the story is very, very interesting, but short and sweet, he was a prisoner, and his captors, they treated him wonderfully. He taught them English. And those captors ended up becoming the go-betweens between the Japanese government and the American government. They were diplomats, using a modern word. History is fascinating. You should enjoy it. This is Donna Sebo. I know we're out of time. I'm so delighted you were able to be with me today. Remember always, you can always find something to learn. And just like the young man I had on the show today, things are not always what they may be portrayed to be. Take time to spend with those people that have walked the walk of life in their own unique way, those that are older than you. Be willing to listen to their stories. Don't close your mind. Sometimes the truth is going to give a picture that may surprise you. It can empower you, or it can make you ask a lot of questions in ways and manners you never dreamed. This is Donna Sebo. You're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have a fabulous weekend. See you back here on Monday, same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.